As well, a new movie that's come out, All the Money in the World. Has anyone been to see it yet? Only a few hands. I still am yet to see it. But if you haven't seen it, it's based on the true story, the story of John Paul Getty, an oil tycoon who in 1973 was the richest man in the free world. It was during this season of incredible prosperity for John Paul Getty that his grandson was kidnapped by a crime cartel in Rome and held to ransom. The kidnappers contacted Getty with their demands for ransom, $17 million. $17 million. Which, despite his incredible wealth, he was $9 billion plus dollars that he had at the time. So $9 billion plus. Despite his incredible wealth, convinced that it would encourage further kidnappings, he refused to pay the kidnappers' demands. There's a whole heap of negotiation went on, and the grandson was actually moved from one group of kidnappers to another group. And the ransom was lowered from $17 to $4 million. And Getty decides he can contribute $1 million towards this. Even though his daughter had no money, he could contribute $1 million, which is the maximum amount he could claim as tax deductible. And it was only once his grandson's ear arrives at one of the major newspaper outlets that Getty decides to begrudgingly pay for his son's safe and yet harmed return. Pretty horrific story, isn't it? Pretty incredible story and pretty messed up. This man choosing money over the well-being of his family. It still struck me that that's a reality we all face, isn't it? Not that we have $17 million, even $4 million, but how often we choose money over people, over relationships, over our relationship with God. Don't get me wrong, it might not be as obvious as this, but that's what we do. Think about all these small sacrifices we make from day to day, week to week. Spending more time at the office to gain a few extra dollars and get everything done. Bringing work home and sitting in front of the TV or maybe while the kids are playing to do it. Checking our emails over the weekend and making sure everything's still going okay at work. Again and again we choose money over God, over family, over friendships, over relationships. And in Luke chapter 12, verse 13, Jesus is confronted by this very same issue. He has these two brothers that come to Jesus and they ask him to settle this argument about their father's inheritance. How should they divide it among themselves? And I'm not sure if you've seen it before, but it happens all the time in families. When someone passes away and there's money, then family can start to divide and separate and work towards getting a greater part of the inheritance. And Jesus responds to these brothers with this odd statement, followed by two parables that show us how Jesus changes our perspective around money and about wealth. What does Jesus say to these two brothers? Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Jesus warns them. He warns us about the allure of wealth, of possessions, of money. With the reminder that there's more to life than accumulating wealth, it is our relationship with others and with God that is most important. And the first parable he tells us about this guy, a farmer, if you like, who has this amazing bumper crops, an amazing year, these bumper crops, and without any acknowledgement of God's provision in his life, without any reference to his family, he starts to tear down his barns, to tear them down to build these new, bigger, better barns to store up his wealth. One good year, and he forgets about everyone else. He forgets about God himself. And he starts to stockpile for the future. You know, that is exactly what our society encourages us to do, isn't it? to store up treasures on earth, to hold onto our wealth, to accumulate more, and so often the desire to gain more overtakes our affection for God. And this subtle shift takes place in our hearts where the pursuit of money for security, financial stability, gradually overtakes our desire and our passion for God. And that is why Jesus says, the pagan world runs after all such things, and your Father knows that you need them. But seek first His kingdom, and all these things will be given to you as well. Jesus knows that where our focus lies, our treasure will be also. And the question and the challenge for each of us this morning, and we'll hear more in a moment, is where is our treasure? Are we seeking God first, His kingdom, trusting He will provide for our needs? He will give us not only what we need in this life, but a treasure in heaven that cannot be stolen, that will never decay, that will last for eternity. See, we're often told the solution to money is allure, is to gain that little bit more, to hold on that little bit tighter, to keep what we've earned, to benefit ourselves instead of bless others. And yet in this second parable in Luke chapter 12, Jesus turns this idea completely upside down. Basically, he says, generosity is the antidote for our love of money. He tells this parable about a servant, a steward who is given responsibility over his master's resources and who over time begins to abuse his place of privilege, to withhold and overindulge himself at the expense of the others in this household. And Jesus said that is not a wise steward. So often we term steward as someone who looks after and holds on to and manages well God's resources. They're the housekeeper. Someone who holds on to God's wealth. And yet a steward in the Bible, and the word that is used, the manager in this passage, literally means house distributor. Not someone who holds on to what they have been given by God. Not someone who sees God's generous provision as their own. But someone who graciously and generously distributes what they have to bless others, to expand God's mission, to build His kingdom. Jesus knew that if we hold on, money becomes our God. But if we let go, if we give and we bless others, His kingdom will come. This idea when everyone will have enough. Because it is not about you or me, but it is about us. The people God made in His image. In a society where we often don't talk about money, I want to invite us to listen. Instead of a sermon from me this week, you'll hear a little bit more from Carl Fass. And if you've been in a group already, and you might have heard this, I've listened to it probably 5 or 6 times, and I keep learning about this issue of money and wealth that challenges me so deeply. If you're not in a group, you'll get to see how good it is, what other people have been seeing. And you get to open your heart this morning and let God speak to you about money, about wealth, about how you can respond maybe differently, about how Jesus calls us to respond. So, Kay, can you put that up for us?
Humphrey Monmouth was a resident in London in the 16th century. He's a very wealthy guy. He traded in cloth. He used to bring it over from Europe and he would sell it to the wealthy elite, even the kind of clerics of London. He met a young man whose name was William Tyndale. Now, William Tyndale was a theologian and a translator, and he wanted to translate the Bible into English. You see, it was only ever in Latin. And Monmouth wanted to see exactly the same thing. Interestingly, the authorities didn't want to see that happen. The authorities didn't want to see the Bible translated from Latin into English. And so what the authorities did was start to put pressure on Tyndale. In fact, Tyndale had to run to Germany to continue his work, and Monmouth continued to support Tyndale. When they found out that Monmouth was supporting Tyndale, they actually arrested him. In May 1528, they brought him under the Tower Bridge on a barge. They brought him through this gate, the Traitor's Gate. Monmouth spent a year in the Tower of London as a prisoner, simply because he wanted to support Tyndale to translate the Bible into English. Monmouth could have a very easy, successful life as a wealthy elite, and yet his focus was to do what Jesus was calling him to do. So John, tell us about Humphrey Monmouth. What was his background and business?
Yeah, in the 1500s, the main industry was cloth. It was like technology is today, or filmmaking even. And cloth in England went all over the world. And Humphrey Monmouth was great at cloth. He was a cloth merchant. And so he was a great businessman in the 1500s, made a heap of money. But it wasn't about making money for him. That wasn't the end goal of his life. He used it to be incredibly generous to actually fund the English Bible, the first translation of the English Bible.
So how did Humphrey Monmouth come in contact with William Tyndale?
Before William Tyndale got interested in translating the Bible, he was preaching at a church in London. And Humphrey Monmouth somehow found his way to that church and heard this preacher who was a very unusual preacher, and there seemed to be a connection there, and said, I want to get to know this guy, I want to get behind this guy.
So why would anybody have a problem with the Bible being translated from Latin into English?
In one sense, it's just tradition. The Bible had always been in Latin. They thought of Latin as an exalted language, higher than English. English was sort of down the list. So we'll just keep it in this sort of traditional, formal language. And the people who wanted to make that decision, they knew Latin, so it wasn't really a problem for them. On the other hand, though, it allowed them to sort of maintain control, the official control. It seems completely foreign to us, and to some degree it should be, but it's tradition's tough to break.
So Monmouth, we can understand that Tyndale was the one who did it. He ran from England, ended up in Germany. But Monmouth, he's continuing to support Tyndale. What's his motivation? What do you know about his motivation?
Yeah, we know that he was taking a huge risk. To support the translation of the English Bible in the 16th century was equivalent to heresy. You could be burned for it. Here's a business guy who has no need of that risk, who says, this is worth doing. We need an English Bible in our generation. I'm willing to go for it. I'm willing to support you. I'm willing to be your gospel patron and stand beside you for that. That's huge. I think it shows his value of Scripture and his understanding of the need of that in his generation.
Yeah. Give us a picture of how wealthy he was. How was he in comparison to everybody else?
Well, there was a season where he was actually put in prison for his work with William Tyndale. And it was so significant that when he was in prison, his employees couldn't work, that the industry started to tank, so they let him out of prison because we got to have this business guy actually in the field. We can't have him tucked away.
So what is your feel in studying him a little, I know that's hard to do, about what his attitude to money and wealth was?
He was risk-taking with it. I mean, Jesus talks about storing up your treasure in heaven versus just piling it up here and building bigger barns. Monmouth lived that. He was generous, sacrificial, personally engaged in using his wealth for the Great Commission, for the spread of the English Bible. That mattered to him. That's unusual today, to step outside of your comfort zone with your wealth. We all want to be comfortable. And here's Monmouth saying, I'm willing not only to put my money where my mouth is, but to be willing to go into prison for it. That's really significant.
So these monasteries actually became very large institutions. What were monasteries like and what difference did they make?
What you had was that monasteries are cropping up all across Europe, and they become farms. They do become businesses, and what we find is that the townsfolks often came to them because they trusted them. And so they became a center not just of education, but they also became a center of commerce, a center of banking. And part of it was based on their education. They were among the most well-educated people in Europe. And part of it was based on the idea of trust. When we think of capitalism, we often think of, you know, markets, and we think of capital, we think of banking, we think of regulation. The Benedictines, in some sense, would have agreed with Adam Smith, who came later, who said that capitalism can only work if people can trust each other, that there's no amount of regulation that will save capitalism if we can't trust each other. And so in a certain sense, the Benedictines, without intending to do it, became the educators and the bankers and a center of life throughout Europe.
I guess today we tend to see here's a group of people that locked themselves away and left the world.
Well, monasteries were communities. People, of course, you know, dedicated their lives to the church, but they didn't lock themselves up. They weren't unworldly. They had their livings to make. And consequently, capitalism was invented in the great monastic communities of Europe.
So these monasteries actually shifted about how they looked at work, and they created more than they needed and therefore created wealth. Give me a bit of a picture of how you saw monasteries growing.
Now, St. Benedictine it was who added the dimension of work, that Buddhist monks here had to go out and beg to eat because they didn't have the women who will grind their grain and make their wheat and make their bread. So the Buddhist monks had to go out and beg. But Benedictine read in the gospel letters of Paul that whoever doesn't work shouldn't eat. So he required his monks to work. Now, that began to change the character of monasteries, that you couldn't beg, you had to work. But it also became the means of the birth of modern technology and knowledge, because the young men, 12, 13, 14 year old, they've come into the monasteries, they've come to learn to pray, get to know God. But now they're having to grind wheat for the whole community and bake bread. So the abbot see that and say, this is terrible. You know, the whole day these guys are working. So let's do something so that to minimize labor. Because the Bible had a very important distinction between work and toil. God is not a meditator. A Hindu God is a meditator. The Bible's God is a worker. He works for 6 days to create. He rests on the seventh. So to be godly means to work for 6 days. But once sin came in, work became toil. You will have to eat of the sweat of your brow, God says to Adam. So toil is curse. Salvation from sin includes salvation from toil. That was the most important theological force creating technology. So now you have these young men, because they are studying, they are not just workers, slaves, they're intellectuals who are studying. So they figure out how to put a little dam on most of the monasteries are next to the rivers, little rivers. You dam the water, have the water fall, run these blades, use that motion to grind your grain, to do all sorts of power machinery. That's how power machinery and technology begins to develop.
The marvelous thing about the monasteries, of course, is they could make long-term economic plans, and they would always be They were meritocracies, of course, because they didn't have to deal with idiot sons. You know, the nobility had to deal with the fact that they'd come along with a guy who'd waste all the money. But in the monasteries, they always took the smart guys and put them in charge. I'm sure there were plenty of idiots in the monastery, but they just didn't give them responsibilities. And they were these wonderfully run factories. And what we've got going on, it was amazing because they early on specialized. And consequently led to a money economy because trade was very inefficient. And so the guys who were making wine bought their food from other places that were raising food. It was an amazing time.
There's one situation where Jesus was asked to adjudicate in a family dispute. There's a brother who wanted justice in family finances. And Jesus answered with a really odd statement. He said, be careful of greed. Relationships are more important. And then he tells a story, a parable. He tells about a man who had a crop on his land that did incredibly well. And without any reference to anybody else, he decides he'd rip down his barns, build bigger barns, and fill them with the crop. Well, that's exactly what happened. And he went home at the end of the harvest with his barns full, feeling like, I've got it made. Yet that night, Jesus says God required his life for him. The point Jesus was making is relationships matter. And the most important relationship is the one you have with God. Did Jesus have much to say about money?
Actually, he did. Jesus speaks more about money than almost any other topic, both in the stories that he tells and his parables and in some of the situations that he deals with. You think about Zacchaeus, for example, you know, come down, I'm staying at your house tonight. And Zacchaeus gives away half of all he owns, and the Gospels make that point. But in the stories and the parables that Jesus tells, he often raises commercial issues that people would be familiar with. Simple things like the lost coin, or the shrewd manager, or the rich young ruler. He talks about situations that people would recognize immediately and talks about money, because people often have to deal with issues of money. That was clearly true in the first century.
In some ways, people kind of see Jesus and wealth, or the church, or Christians and wealth, in two different ways.
Okay.
One is that wealth is just an evil thing, and then we should avoid it.
Yeah, yeah,
did Jesus hold that sort of view?
Not at all. Not at all. He actually had significantly wealthy followers who supported his ministry, and he was glad for them. Luke chapter 8, 1 through 3 tells us, Mary, Joanna, and Susanna provided for Jesus and his disciples out of their means. So if Jesus had a problem with wealthy people, I think he would have said, no, you three don't follow me. You three don't contribute to my ministry. No, give it all away and give it to the poor. And then we see Zacchaeus, when he meets Jesus and Jesus came to his house for dinner, he stands up and says, if I've defrauded anyone, I'm going to repay it fourfold and I'll give half of my possessions to the poor. And Jesus's next line is, today salvation has come to this house. Jesus doesn't say, what, you only give half to the poor? You should give it all away. No, Jesus says, today salvation has come to this house. So Jesus, he wants our hearts to be first loving God and then using wealth for his purposes, not using it for our purposes or even our, you know, fatter, happier lifestyle. But he wants us to use it for his kingdom purposes.
Jesus said quite a bit about greed and giving. The most important statement, I think, in Jesus' teaching is where he says that you can either serve God or money. So there's a sense in which money has a religious power. So what we used to do with God, we'd trust God, we'd love God, we'd serve God. What Jesus said was, even in his day, and even more so in our day, there's the potential to trust, love, and serve money instead. So in the Sermon on the Mount, he says, you cannot serve both God and mammon. Either you will love one and hate the other, you'll be devoted to one and despise the other. So there's love and service and trust. But trust comes through in the following verses where he says, look at the lilies, look at the birds of the air, God provides for them.
So it's not that Christian faith, the teaching of Jesus and a kind of a commercial economy are actually at odds with each other.
Well, on the contrary, in the sense that basic gospel values, biblical values, call them what you like, right, keep getting rediscovered as essential ingredients to commercial life. And once more, Carl, I don't think that anybody saying that commercial life in itself is evil. I mean, it's how people meet their daily needs, right? And so there is something, I think, strongly biblical about God providing these foundations for us to meet our material needs, which isn't to say that he isn't in and through that. I mean, he obviously is in and through that. But it's part of God's love for us that he hasn't said, well, that's it, you can starve. Right? No, here are the means for doing this. But this is about your material welfare, your material, and I care for that. But of course, I care for a whole lot more than that, which is why he sends his son. Jesus makes it clear that you can't serve God and money. That's the trouble with money and wealth. It can sit in the place of God, just like idols do. That's the bit which Jesus says is the difference between life and death.
The problem with all idols is they're gods that fail. So they don't bring the security and satisfaction that we hope for. There's a book by a Sri Lankan evangelical, Vinoth Ramachandra, on idolatry, where the title's worth the price of the book, Gods That Fail. And that's the critique of idolatry in the Bible. It's a folly. So the problem with trusting in material things and serving material things is that they will demean you and they will fail you, whereas trusting in the living and true God is something that does bring lasting satisfaction and security.
You're coming in contact with the kind of Humphrey Monmouths of today.
Right.
So, John, are they the same? Is that attitude that Monmouth had still happening?
It is, and it's quiet, and it's often behind the scenes, just like it was with Tyndale and Monmouth. Gospel patrons aren't raising their hand, asking for attention. They're not trying to be the one actually on camera, even. They're saying, this is who God's made me be. I'm going to fuel gospel ministry. I'm going to partner with those who are doing the work of the kingdom, and I'll be generous towards it. But I'm happy to be behind the scenes. I'll be focused. I'll be good at business. And in some ways, I like to parallel it with an Old Testament king who they would go out to battle. They would win the resources, but they didn't win the resources for themselves. They won the resources for the kingdom. And many Christian businessmen today are doing that. They're in the marketplace. They're on the stock exchange. They're doing their jobs, winning the resources and fueling the kingdom because of it.
So there are plenty of Christians who are blessed, particularly in the West, with either having a lot of money or the ability to make a lot of money. Paul is good on this. Paul talks about having the gift of giving. It's one of the spiritual gifts. Now, if you've got the gift of giving, then give. And how does that happen? Well, you have to make the money to give it away. Wasn't it John Wesley who said, you know, earn all you can, right? Gain all you can, give all you can. So it isn't that I think either Jesus himself or that the church has turned around and said, if you're a rich person, forget it. You can't get into the kingdom. If you're a rich person who worships money, well, then yes. Right? That's the problem. That's a blocker. Why? Because you're not loving the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and strength.
Somebody who's following Jesus, what would they look like in their wealth? Does this mean that everybody that follows Jesus is going to be poor and give it all away? How do we deal with that?
Well, Jesus did say some pretty absolute things about giving all your money away and following me. At other points, though, he talks about generosity. So I think it can be an individual thing. We tend to think of greed as simply an attitude, but the New Testament had a very different view. So Paul, for example, thought that you could spot greed without getting inside someone's head or heart. So there has to be an expression of our attitude towards money, which leads to generous giving. So Christian people will be known for their generosity. And this was the case in the first century. There's a pagan author in the second century who said that you can spot a Christian because they're easily duped. They'll put you up for a week and they'll stop eating themselves to give you hospitality. So there's a sense in which the early church was known for three things: for worshipping the true and living God rather than idols, for being sexually pure, and being generous and willing to share.
As somebody in the industry, if I can use that term, how do you keep yourself balanced? Because you're kind of around it, talking about
That's
it
right.
all of the time.
Yeah, give it away. That's the answer to that.
Yeah.
Establish a gap, what one of my Christian mates says, you know, live the life of the gap. In other words, always consume or spend money at a level which is below that that you can afford. So the gap obviously serves two purposes. You know, the first obviously is to make way for your giving. And as Christians, you know, we are asked to give. God loves a cheerful giver, so we're not under law, but we give. And creating the gap enables us to do that. But I think that there's a deeper reason here. In the end, giving is a way of protecting your heart, insulating your heart against what we all feel. And we all know it's a seductive thing. It's potentially an idol. All idols are seductive. And if you can give the money away, if you can say, all right, yep, okay, this much, you know, is mine and this much belongs to the Lord, give it away. That enables you to discipline yourself and not to be captured by it. You can turn and give it away. I remember a very wealthy investment banker friend of mine who was a Christian, and he approached me gingerly once and said, oh, he said, they tell me that you tithe. And I said, well, I said, that's right, actually. He said, oh, he said, yeah. He said, I know I should. I'm troubled by that. And I said, well, why are you troubled by that? And he said, do you have any idea what 10% of my income is? And I said, no, and I don't want to know. What I do know is this. Even after you've given the 10% away, the 90% of it is yours. And you've got 90% of a very large number. Right? I mean, God doesn't ask us to do these things to make life miserable. God says, I want to protect you from various forms of temptation, various things that could potentially supplant me in your life. And for most wealthy Christians, certainly, but even poor people, frankly, right? The idea that money could grip us in a way that the Lord Jesus doesn't is only too prevalent.
So, Jagger, we're here in Holy Trinity, Clapham, and the Thornton family were a very important family for this church and for the work of William Wilberforce. Tell us about the Thornton family.
Yeah, so the Thornton family, originally, they were Russian merchants who were trading between the Baltic and Hull in the north of England. And after a while, they settled in Clapham here. And they were Christians, and they believed in Jesus, and they were very wealthy as a result of all this, the merchant trading. And I guess what's so staggering about them is how they used their money. So they made a lot of money, and they didn't just go, right, we're keeping it all for ourselves, but they used their money in so many amazing ways. So John Thornton, who was very, very rich, he was the person actually who gave the money so this church could be built. So this church was built because of him. He also invested his money into supporting lots of different vicars and different churches, but also used his money in so many other different ways as well. So here we've got buildings, we've got vicars, but actually here was William Wilberforce in this church working for the abolition of the slave trade. A lot, if you like, of the financial backing for that great project came from John Thornton. So it was amazing to see how he used his money.
How do you reckon that changed in his mind? Like, why would he have taken that attitude?
Yeah, it's a good question. I guess at the end of the day, he was going, this money I've been given, it's not my money that's all about me. Actually, it is God's money. God's given me the gifts to have this money, and I'm to steward it wisely. And part of that stewarding for him meant giving some away. So, of course, he would have used some of his money for himself, for everyday needs, food, etc., housing. But actually, he goes, actually, extra, I don't need to live a lavish lifestyle. I'm going to use it to give away. And apparently, he gave away, because he was so wealthy, he gave away 6/7 of his income. So 1/7 of his income was for him and for using for all that he was doing in life. But 6/7 he gave away to all these different causes.
This series is about Jesus as a game changer, and as you consider the gospel patrons and all that you've done, how is Jesus a game changer in this world?
Jesus fueled all the gospel patrons in the world. The only way you can replace the love of money is with a better love, with the love of God. Jesus is the game changer because he fuels the change that a person has to go through between loving money and loving God instead. That choice of laying down the service of money, the love of money, to actually value God,
comes because Jesus enters your heart. And that's what happened for John Thornton in the 18th century. Here's a businessman, a wealthy merchant, and he writes this: Jesus reigns, and he will preserve his justified ones. May the Lord strengthen us that we may grow in grace and in the knowledge of him, and our hearts leap within us every time we hear his sweet name articulated. Have you heard a businessman talk like that before? He goes on to say, may the Lord keep us earnest for the salvation of our dear friends and relatives and all around us. Let us not with Peter be disturbed with the high winds and the storms of life, but keeping our eyes riveted on Jesus, go through good report and evil report, steadfast, unmovable, ever abounding in the work of the Lord. That quote from John Thornton changed the game for me as I studied gospel patrons, because I saw deep in the heart of this man was a passionate love for Jesus that fueled his generosity. It fueled how he thought. It fueled the men in ministry that he partnered with. He was a man for Jesus. And his final words when he was dying was, happy in Jesus. All is as well as it could be. Precious, precious. And then he died. But everyone in that room knew what his last word was. It was Jesus.
Profoundly challenging, isn't it? To understand this allure that is so real and so prevalent for each of us as we go about our lives. This allure that money, that wealth brings. The sense of security and stability that it provides within us. And yet the challenge you've heard this morning is that we cannot serve two gods. And the challenge is not to change ourselves and try and become more generous. Challenge is to keep looking at the cross, isn't it? Challenge is to keep looking at Jesus and allowing that to change us so deeply, so profoundly, so continually, that we don't need to hold on to what we have, but we can start to live in the ways of Jesus, who gave generously and graciously, gave everything, gave sacrificially. And you know, challenges me. It really challenges me. And I trust that it challenges all of us. And I don't need to tell you what you need to do with your money, because I trust that God will. If only we would keep our eyes on Christ and on the cross and not let money become an idol, that thing that guides us, that drives us. We actually went to our job and said, you know what, it's not the dollars that I earn. That's great, but it's a mission God has given. It's a people that he's calling me to serve. It's the ways that the money I get enables me to bless and to grow and to build God's kingdom. That's the hearts that God longs for us to have with wealth. It's a heart I long to have. You know, if you're anything like me, you're still working. And so I trust that God will continue to speak to each of us and change us to be more and more like Jesus. That what we have is not what we hold, but we hold on to Jesus and we give everything else for God's work. And to bless others, to build his kingdom, to make Jesus known. I want the team to come and to lead us, and I might pray for us as they come. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this incredible gift you have given in Jesus. God, a gift that is so much more beautiful and powerful and life-transforming than money could ever be. God, in those moments where we hold on to or where we look to money, our jobs, all these things for security, I pray that we would look to Jesus. God, we would look to Jesus with a heart that is so grateful for all he has done, that we cannot help but be moved to respond. To respond in each moment of each day, to give our lives for your purposes in our workplace. To invest our hearts in our families, that we might see them grow in love for Jesus. To invest our resources in your kingdom work of making Jesus known in our world. God, the gift of Jesus is so much beautiful, so much more powerful, than the money our society treasures. God, allow us to speak into that. Allow us to model another alternative, a life shaped by the cross of Christ. And we ask it in his name. Amen.